I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We are so excited to bring you this episode after we spent a long, thoughtful, and delicious-sounding time with René Redzepi, the chef of the restaurant Noma in Copenhagen. It's a place that's been ranked 4 times as the best restaurant in the world. Now, okay, I know it's sort of inherently goofy to say, yes, this place is objectively the best restaurant in the world. So what's impressive about them isn't the title exactly, but the fact that while you may have never eaten their food, thousands of other chefs and cooks have taken cues from what they do, and you may well have tasted some of Noma's ideas in action wherever you are. So here's an example. Plenty of people grew up foraging for wild foods, but if you've ever heard a high-end chef talking about that sometime in the last 15 years, it might have been because of Noma. Or if you know a restaurant that recently started filling up its dry storage room with jars of fermentation products, it might have been because of Noma. Or if you suddenly heard that the Nordic countries were amazing places to eat, it was almost certainly because of Noma. And leading Noma since the beginning, when he was just 24 years old, was René Redzepi. He's the son of a Danish mother and an Albanian Muslim father, and he started cooking because he'd failed out of high school and really didn't know what else to do. We talked with him as he was getting ready to tour North America to promote his new book, written with David Zilber, The Noma Guide to Fermentation. He was in Copenhagen, we were in New York, and I have to say I was pretty excited to talk with him about fermentation and life beyond the kitchen. Chef, thank you so much for talking with us today. I'm super excited to spend time with you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
So congratulations on the book. It is incredible. Let me start by asking you what actually might be sort of a dumb question. But fermentation is literally one of the oldest things humans have done with food, right? We have always preserved food by fermenting. Wine, beer, cheese, all that. So what does it mean to be creative with fermentation?
I don't think that's a dumb question. Well, what does it mean? Well, you're right. You're absolutely right when you say that on a daily basis, we love fermented foods already. We have them in our daily lives. We just don't see them as products of fermentation. But the reality is that we have only started to scratch the surface of what's available for us to do through the work of ingredients and microorganisms. Mm-hmm. And so for us at Noma, how we innovate in that, it's for us like having more letters in the vocabulary. Or since we're from Denmark, we always say that we have more Legos in our box. Before fermentation, we had a handful of Legos. Now we have a basketful. It just is something extraordinary. I mean, it is what has been defining our restaurant for the past decade.
Hmm. And, what are some of the things that you're excited about like right now in your fermentation lab?
Currently it's mushroom season. We have had almost 2,200 kilos of wild mushrooms in. Uh-huh. And we're testing all sorts of things here. How to put it in misos, how to make vinegars. And some of it is turning out to be something special. We've also, in the past couple of years, been testing quite a bit something that we call garums. Now, people may have heard of the idea of a garum before, but a garum, to explain briefly, is essentially like in Thailand you have fish sauce. Well, imagine the European equivalent of that. So we started producing garums, but not just with fish, with all sorts of things. And some of the things that we are coming through with, they're really, really special. I'd say the best one we've done is probably grasshopper garum.
You know what?
It's so good.
I think for people who are not used to the idea of eating bugs, that's like already a distance for them to travel. But
the thing is, you can't see it's a bug. It's just like this potent, robust liquid that is a mix between soy sauce, vinegar, and then a deep, rich mole from Oaxaca. I mean, it's made from grasshoppers. It's just an extraordinary thing. I remember the first time we did it. And, you know, we opened this bag of grasshoppers and they were alive. And it was sort of took us by surprise. We didn't know this. And so a few of them escaped. And then in the following 6 months, every time we came to work in the fermentation lab, we heard this little sound, you know, like a cricket sound. And none of us could find it. It was just hidden somewhere in the lab. But of course, all the other ones we fermented.
Yeah. What if they were there just like ready to avenge their lost brethren? Like they were there haunting you.
That's for next life. I'm sure of that for me. I'm going to be a bug and some cook is going to ferment me.
But, you know, I think, you know, again, for people who are a little freaked out by that, but you wouldn't be that worried if someone said, oh, I was making a fish sauce with shrimp or with lobster, which are essentially the underwater equivalent of...
Yeah, actually, that's how we found out you could use crickets, because we're reading up on the sort of the chemistry behind it. It turns out that we stumbled on this paper that we're trying to figure out why so many people that have shrimp allergies also have grasshopper and cricket allergies. And then we thought, okay, well, let's test it out. Let's just replace shrimp with crickets, and it turns out that it becomes amazing. But if people say they have shrimp allergy, we also tell them, okay, you got to stay away from the crickets.
Yeah. So getting back to the metaphysical element, maybe the spiritual element of fermentation, I have to tell you, I am obviously nowhere near your level in terms of a fermenter. I'm barely a hobbyist, but every once in a while, I'll make something really simple, a sauerkraut, or I'll salt some peppers, or, you know, something that just kind of let it hang out, or maybe just a bread dough. And I find this really interesting reaction in me, which is I get a thrill. Like I love that moment every day where I go and like just take a look at it. And I feel like there's almost something psychologically satisfying and exciting about fermenting things. Do you ever feel like it's a little bit?
Yeah.
I mean, you study on the science of it, but do you feel like it's magical?
Of course, it's not magical. It's being analog in a digitalized world. That's what I think it is. It's simply taking your time. I mean, when you make a sauerkraut and it might take you 4 days, you would never sit and download a file that take you 4 days. You'd press eject many times over. Here, you just have to wait. And your hands have to do the work as well. And there's just something, I believe, very satisfying in that. And in particularly in these days where everything is so rushed and we're sort of stuck on the phone or whatever, on the computer, and to suddenly actually having to take your time, and it's not a thing that demands you in a big way, say like kids or a dog or something. I mean, you just mix your ingredients together and let it rest, and you can watch at it when you feel like. And then suddenly it's ready for you to taste and start doing something with. And so you feel like you accomplished something, you actually did something, and it feels very different to how the times are going and moving, you know,
it's like
downloading. This is analog life.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. That's super interesting. I was thinking there's something to the idea of, you know, this is goofy and I only became a parent fairly recently, but before that it was like this sort of weird thing where like you're watching this thing that you helped make grow, and you know it's growing outside of your control, you know. So maybe I don't know, maybe because like I'm a dad now, I think about it all the time, like, oh, what's my kid gonna be like 20 years from now? It's like, oh, what's this sauerkraut gonna be like a week from now? It's exciting to imagine.
Yeah, well, with kids, worrying gets a new meaning, and then you can add ferments on top of that too. That's a that's a like a worrying extra.
Yeah. I'll pack some like, you know, pickles in her backpack and just don't tell her about it. Let her walk around. I can sort of have the whole thing in a package. That was Chef Rene Redzepi. His new book with David Zilber is The Noma Guide to Fermentation. And we'll be back with more Rene in a minute.
I mean, you can't even begin to imagine back then. We would taste this herb and it would taste the slightest of coriander, and we would be like in the seventh heaven. You know, it was like the biggest revelation. And we'd put this herb on everything and we'd tell our guests, taste it, it has a slight hint of coriander. And people would say like, so why don't you just put coriander on? And we'd be like, no, but this grows on a beach. Can't you understand this? This is from here.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're spending this episode with Rene Redzepi, the chef of the world-renowned restaurant Noma. We just talked with him about the power of fermentation, and next, we talk about how a restaurant can shape a region, and maybe the world. Let me ask you another question. In the introduction to your book, you wrote that this book is one way for a, you know, frankly, what Noma is, a super high-end 40-seat restaurant, but it's a way for you to influence the world beyond your doors, down to regular home cooks. So I think not everyone is so blatant in their desire to like influence the world. But why is that kind of influence important to you?
I totally believe in the power of fermentation, and I love and I believe in the act of cooking and eating together with family, with friends. And I do also acknowledge, I see that in my own life, that cooking, while, you know, having a career and kids and picking them up and rushing home and, you know, the weather's dreadful and then you have like 30 minutes to whip something up. I mean, it's probably more stressful than anything at that point. But that's when the idea of fermentation comes in so handy, because it's like glue. Fermentation is like the glue that puts together this bag of spinach and that chicken breast. A chicken wing garum can glue them together, so it's suddenly delicious and a meal. And you know, it's not easy starting to use all these ferments. I mean, people could just start using the ones that are already available in a supermarket, get comfortable with them, start understanding them. It's like a pantry full of things that just makes cooking easier once you learn how to do it. And then once you start experimenting, and if people have, say, our book to do so, I dream that people who buy the book, they find that one ferment that to them becomes like, you know, Tabasco sauce is for some, or that fermented chili sauce that they kind of put and always have at the table, you know? Because if you do that, it becomes like a thing you can't be without. Some of my friends have that with soy sauce, or they have it with miso, for instance. Yeah. Currently for us in our home, it's actually the chicken wing garum. Which is it's just the perfect thing. I don't know how to explain it other than you have to imagine that you roast a chicken in a wood-fired oven, and when it comes out, the skin is all crunchy and the steam is arises and the broth that's sort of, you know, caramelized in the bottom of the sheet pan. Imagine that just condensed into like 10 drops. With freshness, acidity, aroma, times 10. It's just an extraordinary thing. Wow. So, yeah, it is. I mean, it is seriously wow. The other day I was making a salad and I had this chicken wing garum. So I just mixed it with olive oil and these thick beginning of winter greens. And it was like having meat, except much more juicy, because I was eating greens.
Oh, yeah. But you had that intense flavor of meat concentrated in this sauce.
Exactly.
This fermented sauce.
Exactly.
That's awesome. Hmm. Speaking of the ways in which you're influential, one of the ways that you've been super influential is that Noma, you may have a different perspective, but for me, certainly United States, I think for much of the rest of the world, Noma, the restaurant, kind of single-handedly established the Nordic countries, I think, as places for incredible food. You know, back when the rest of the world thought all you ate was fish and potatoes, right? But you grew up not like the typical Dane. Your father is an immigrant, an Albanian Muslim, And you went back and forth, I believe, from Denmark to Macedonia when you were a kid.
So how it was called Yugoslavia back then.
Oh, right. Before the breakup in 91. So how do you think about that, your own heritage, your own experience growing up in Denmark, and now being seen as this sort of high priest of Danish food culture?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, how do I think about that? But I mean, it's a difficult question. You know, it's how do you see yourself? And I mean, I'm born in Denmark and I feel Danish, yet I'm different. I grew up eating different foods. I never actually grew up hearing the story, the typical children's stories. There was a time when my family, they were in war. You know, it was just a different. But I do believe that actually it gave me an advantage further in my life, because say, have I grown up eating rye bread, liver paste and licorice, which is it's not only the diet in Denmark, but I will bet you most kids in their lunchbox, they have liver paste and rye bread. You know, it's just this everyday common thing that you stop seeing value in, I believe. And so when we started going about Noma and trying to, you know, push forward some sort of identity, you know, you're in this, but you haven't really grown up intimately with everything around you in terms of food. And then when you taste it, you see it for what it is, as opposed to maybe just this everyday common thing that you grow up with, you know. So I think that really gave me something actually to my advantage. It's a good thing to be able to see your culture hovering from above. But I think in Denmark or in Scandinavia, I mean, you say the high priest of Nordic kitchen. Here we don't see it like that. I honestly, and I really believe mean that, I don't see it like that, because there's so many amazing things happening, and it doesn't feel like we have here in Denmark some sort of special advantage to the best restaurant in Sweden or anything like that. I mean, we're all in it together. We all understand that there's a perfect window for us that got opened, and that happens rarely. And suddenly people know of us. People want to come and experience the food. It's an opportunity, and we need to do this together. And I think that's still the main spirit of this. So I don't see it as there being one. There are many in this this push.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I haven't spent very much time there. I've had the extraordinary pleasure of coming to see you at Noma and some of your colleagues in Copenhagen, and I'm astonished. And certainly, you know, beyond that, I've had the chance to go to the Faroe Islands and to Iceland and to see some of the things that are going on in the Nordic region. And it is incredible, this sort of community of creativity. And it's almost like when, you know, I grew up, I was a child of the 80s and 90s, and like when grunge was really the thing musically in the U.S., you know, everyone looked to Seattle, everyone looked to Portland. There are these moments when like, oh, so much of the culture is influenced by one place or one region. And I feel like the Nordic countries really have that spirit. And I think a lot of it is like a community of creativity.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you.
But at the same time, I mean, do you feel like the, you know, a lot of the cooking that people are outside of the region are hearing about is superficially similar to what you do at Noma, in that it's about focusing on Nordic traditions, focusing on Nordic ingredients. And for a long time, that was really exciting because, again, people didn't know what Woodruff was. You know, you were bringing forth all these ingredients people didn't realize were delicious. But there's also like,
I mean, it's so much more than that, all of this, what's going on. I mean, the Nordic regions in terms of dining culture is an insect if you compare it to Japan or Thailand or any of these incredible food places. We do not eat very diverse and amazingly. We actually don't. It's a type of meat and potatoes type of place. It's in terms of dining culture, I mean, I remember going to my friends and there would be this one plate of food and there would be a pyramid of a food stuff on it. And then you'd sit there in silence and eat it. You travel the world and you go to a Mexican table and there's like an array of small dishes all over the place. And you're like eating and cooking at the same time. And it's a different way of eating. So Denmark or the Scandinavian countries, we're far from that still. And maybe that's why as a restaurant, can we call it a movement or as a restaurant moment? It's so exciting for all of us because it seems like we can just do whatever we want, you know? In one way, we have tradition, but in another way, the tradition is not weighing us down to the point where if you step a little bit to the right, it seems as a breaking with the 500-year-old way of doing things, you know? It's like, see what happens kind of thing. And I actually think, but I think that's important. I think you have to do that. Sometimes when I talk to my chef friends in Japan, you know, they're sort of stifled from the tradition. They almost can't move or even nudge the slightest forward without somebody saying, why, you know? We can experiment. I mean, you can, like, imagine 10 years ago when we found these ants in our forest that tasted like lemon. We put them on the menu. And at first, it was a little bit of a shock. But now, you can find 10 restaurants in the vicinity of Noma that might have them on the menu at a certain season. And it's not like a thing anymore, you know? So in that sense, progress happens super fast when you're open to it. And that's what we're seeing here as well. That is really, really happening so fast.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I also feel like the tension between being bound by tradition and creativity, or the tension between like rules, structures you place on yourself to have to move within, focus your creativity, right? In the way that, music, if you put a 4-4 beat on something, well, on one hand, well, that's stifling. You have to have a 4-4 beat. But on the other hand, it's like, that gives you the foundation to then like poke and prod against the rhythm, right? So for a long time at Noma, you served only ingredients native to Nordic countries, I believe. So no lemon, no olive oil. And that forced you to be creative.
Yeah, that's what we did in the beginning. Yeah, absolutely. That forced us.
And you started to loosen up.
Yeah, we started to loosen up because, of course, we discovered all the ingredients and we spent some time getting to know that. And then you can't even begin to imagine back then. We would taste this herb and it would taste the slightest of coriander and we would be like in the seventh heaven. You know, it was like the biggest revelation. And we'd put this herb on everything and we'd tell our guests, taste it. It has a slight hint of coriander. And people would say like, so why don't you just put coriander on? And we'd be like, no, but this grows on a beach. Can't you understand this? This is from here. We have the same thing as in Thailand, as the Mexicans. It just looks different. Isn't it amazing? And then from that, it moved into us trying to do something with these ingredients. That's when fermentation really started to happen for us, because, you know, we're in the proper season. We're stuck with all these ingredients like that were in abundance. And then came the cold winter, which is certain for us every year, 6 to 7 months of hardship, actually, where you don't really know what's going to come through the door if anything grows. And so we started thinking about what could we do to all this food stuff. And then obviously coming from a cold climate region of the world, you do realize that the idea of pickling or preserving food, I should say, is something that's a part of who you are. I mean, we always grew up understanding that. And we didn't really think that there was a difference between pickling or drying or fermentation. I mean, honestly, I didn't even know what fermentation was. Everything happened by total chance for us. But once we delved into this world of preserving, slowly we're pushed into fermentation as well. And with that, you're pushed into the world. You're pushed into understanding what else is there, who else ferments. And suddenly you're in Japan, and you're in Korea, and you're in Thailand, and you're in Mexico. And you're traveling the world, learning, understanding. And then at a certain point, you just stop thinking, okay, our dogma is to have this restaurant that uses only chives from this specific region. But you open up yourself to a different way of working. And it's actually changes for the better.
Yeah. And you have a staff who come to you from literally all the way around the world, right? You have an incredibly international staff. They're drawn to you because you were known as being this extraordinary restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these people
absolutely.
Yeah, come to you without any experience or knowledge of these Nordic ingredients and Nordic traditions, but they may come mm-hmm. from Mexico, like you said, and they come from the United States, and they come from Japan. How do you, as a creative leader, how do you harness that diversity of perspectives? Like, how do you make that work for the restaurant?
Oof. I mean, honestly, sometimes it is lost in translation. Or do you in America have that game telephone?
Sure.
As a child, did you play that? You know, where you whisper something, you sit in, and sometimes it's like that. I might tell something to the sous chef, that tells something to the chef de partie, that tells something to the apprentice. And, you know, that goes up. And all of these people, one might be from Morocco, and then one from Mexico, and blah, 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 blah. And suddenly you come back and you ask for a fish, and here's a pigeon in front of you. You know what I mean? Despite that, it is truly an amazing thing that when we work on our creativity and we work on how to move forward, that we can put in all these different ways of looking at the same problem, because it makes a huge difference. It really, really does. So in our test kitchen, we might have a person from Mexico, we might have a person from America, there's somebody from Australia maybe there's a couple of Danish people, and so on and so on. And then, you know, we attack a problem or we attack an idea or an ingredient. And then, you know, the Lebanese guy who's in the test kitchen might say, well, you know, in back home with the beetroots, we do like this and this and that and so on. And that adds to the pool of these ideas that you can then, you know, sort of mix up and make use of in its right time. And that to me is creativity, you know, taking your ideas, your past experiences, and then putting them together with the moment. And so I believe the more of these imagery and knowledge you have, the better you will be in being a creative person. Having that said, you still need the structure, like you also said, you know. The work hours are from this to this, and from this and this moment, we all work like this, and then afterwards we clean up, and then we move on to a different way of working, and so on and so on. And it's really, it's made us who we are. I mean, Noma's run by immigrants, 100%. I would say the restaurant revolution in particularly Denmark, it's run by immigrants.
That's so interesting.
Some of them are from America. Some are, you know, but it's people that have traveled to a new place, a different country, and the vast majority are actually foreigners.
That's the chef René Redzepi of Noma in Copenhagen. And stick around, because in a minute we're going to hear about where he loves to travel and eat. And then Dan Souza from America's Test Kitchen brings us a simple home fermentation project with a serious payoff.
My favorite is doing cultured butter. I think it's a really big bang for your buck. And you can make stuff that honestly rivals what you can buy at the store. And it's really cool when you can actually do that.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Welcome back to our long chat with René Redzepi, sometimes called the most influential chef in the world. And in this last part of our conversation, we get a little personal. There's a dishwasher in your restaurant, a man named Ali Sanko.
He's the man.
He's from Ghana, I think, right?
Gambia.
Gambia, I'm sorry. And you recently made him a part owner of the restaurant.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, Ali, he's the oldest in our kitchen. his name is Ali. My father passed away. His name was Ali as well. My father came to Denmark. He was a dishwasher. Ali was a dishwasher for many years at Noma. But besides that, he's just, you know, sometimes they're the people that just define who you are. I mean, they go through a room and everybody gets to be happy. And that's Ali. Ali is just always the spirit of our space, of our place. And I couldn't see our restaurant without him. And so, yeah, so we gave him a little chunk of the restaurant. He's been there since day one. It's as much his effort that actually made the positive difference to everything than the head chef or the creative chef or anything like that. Today, though, I will say he's not in the dishwasher anymore. It was a big thing for me to tell him, Ali, come on, you're 63. Come on, let's go. Why don't you just step out of that cramped, hot, humid space and come into the guest and hang out? I mean, people want to be with you and see you. So it took him like 3-4 weeks, and then slowly but surely now he's just walking around the guest and high-fiving people and being honestly the perfect host.
Oh, that's awesome. Can I tell you something? I have to admit to you, when I first heard about Noma restaurant, I'm like, oh, that sounds cool. And I just kind of filed it away. I was like, oh, it's some place I'll probably never get to. And, you know, I'm sure they're doing cool stuff. And intellectually, that was interesting and just sort of outside of my realm, my world of existence. But the moment that made me think, God, I want to go there, is when I'd heard that you were going on stage to accept an award. Mm-hmm. I believe it was one of the times you were voted best restaurant in the world. And you had planned on bringing Ali with you. He couldn't make it. Mm-hmm. And so you and your team went up with t-shirts of his face. And I thought, that is such an incredible gesture. And that has to say something so powerful about who you are as a team. And it's and everything I've read really feels like there is a sense of family within the Noma world, within this community.
Exactly.
For good and for ill. And one of the things I think about a lot, is you work a ton. I read in one of your books, you know, you're often, you know, leaving crack of dawn, coming home at 2 a.m. There are moments where you've written notes to your wife and said, I'll see you in 10 days. How do you balance your career and your restaurant family life with your own family life?
It is like that question is like staring into the biggest knot in the universe, the size of a football field, you know, and you have to untangle that. I mean, how do you do that? How do you have a restaurant that's open at night when your family is free? And operate that and make your guest happy and are there for the team. That is very difficult, I have to say. I don't know. I honestly don't know how to strike the perfect balance. I will tell you, we work on this all the time. And, you know, thank you for saying all these kind things about our team and family-like, because I do believe that we have a great team. And I do also believe that we do well with each other, but it isn't always like that, you know. I had many years of my career where I was a terrible, terrible leader. I just couldn't handle it. I just didn't know what to do with anything. And with all the problems, everything became disasters. You know, the smallest things became disasters. But I always wanted to do the best that I could to change things. And some of the things I've learned on how to create a balance is, you have to simply just tell yourself nothing is life or death. You know what I mean? It's like if things go wrong, they go wrong. You've tried the best that you can, and we really try the best that we can. We're always looking for ways to just make the work better. And so, say next year, we won't be open Saturday dinners anymore. And that's a strictly family decision. It's also a decision that's made for the team. You know, I mean, when do you ever get a Saturday night off? Well, we will have it all the time. from now on. But we are also Restaurant Noma. I mean, we built ourselves into this position. 10 years ago, you know, on a Wednesday night, it wouldn't be uncommon if we only had 18 guests or 16 guests. Lunches, practically zero. I mean, you're just there all the time. There's no money to hire anyone. And I think it's important that if we are to change our industry, I don't know anyone who doesn't want to actually have a more human work hours. There's something about the value that we put towards food in general that is completely off. I mean, listen, Noma is very expensive, so we've taken care of our stuff today. But just in general, I think people misunderstand how cheap food is, actually, just in general. And if we were all to imagine a situation in which the salad person, the farmer, the lorry driver, everyone involved in bringing all the different ingredients to your table, if they were all to have a middle-class life standard with a house in the suburbs and two kids and an annual vacation, I mean, just imagine how much more expensive food would be if that would be the case, right? So I think that there's a, you know, there's a, the obvious things that you can do, which is be good with each other, be respectful, give opportunity, feed each other well, and smile at each other and tell each other you do well. And then there's this this thing about work hours. How much do you work? Well, it all depends on how much you can charge for the meal. I mean, does it make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the economy of food, it's even at the highest level.
The economy of food is, yeah, I mean, it's complex, difficult, but I wholeheartedly believe that that if you have very cheap food, it's because somebody else is paying for it
right
somewhere.
Yeah, with their backs and their bodies and their knees.
Yeah, something that you don't see.
Yeah. You, let me change gears a little bit. You travel quite a lot. And you've brought the team with you, the whole, you know, you've done these sort of famous pop-ups of Noma in Mexico, Noma in Japan, Noma in Australia. And you personally travel a lot to recharge. Where have you been going? Where are you excited to go? And what are you seeing there that inspires you?
I have to say, my second love in my life is Mexico.
Yeah.
It is... I mean, in some ways, it's because it reminds me of being in Yugoslavia as a child, where life would be very rural. I mean, I have these images of you know, wanting a glass of milk, and then my aunt, she goes and actually milks the cow, and water would only be for certain hours of the day, and meals would be home cooked, always cooked over fire, no refrigeration, and so on. And so when I travel in Mexico, you still see that all over the place. And I find it to be very inspiring, and I also find it to be incredibly, incredibly delicious. And actually, it influences Noma constantly, particularly the way that a meal, when you sit at a Mexican table, is very rarely just a plate. There's things happening on the table, small plates everywhere, a salsa here, a paste there, and so on and so on.
You're sharing
use your hands to eat. Yeah. Exactly. It's such a communal way of eating, and it's, you know, it's eating in its essence, in a way. And it's funny because when I grew up and we sat and ate in Macedonia, say there was a rice serving, there was always be chiles on the side. And then this big pan of rice that had been cooked in the wood-fired oven would come to the table, and everybody would sit on the floor and would sit in a circle, and then everybody would eat from the same sheet pan.
Yeah.
And you intuitively knew, okay, this part of the sheet pan is for me. You know, that's my portion. Mm. And then you just sort of ate from the same sheet pan.
Yeah.
And so when I travel in Mexico, I guess that's something that reminds me of that time, and also reminds me of this act of eating, that it's supposed to be something for people, that people has to be the center point of it. You know, the creativity is amazing, of course, but if you lose that connection with people, then it doesn't matter how creative your food are, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Hearing you talk about that eating out of the same pan reminded me of this moment where I had the chance to visit a Senegalese family here in New York. And they told me that their tradition was that everyone always ate out of the same bowl. And so the meals were served on a table with one giant bowl and everyone had their spoon. Mm-hmm. And again, like you said, you sort of intuitively knew what area of it was yours and what was someone else's. But as a gesture of honor, you know, the younger people would take, if they happen to have a really choice piece of meat, maybe the chicken thigh was on their side or something, they would scoop it and hand it to like an older person. And there was all this going on in the same bowl. And what they explained to me was, eating this way reminds us that we are always responsible for each other.
Hmm. Yeah, that's cool.
And I thought that was such an incredible and beautiful idea. It's been so great to talk with you, Chef. Thank you so much.
No, thank you.
René Redzepi is the chef of Noma in Copenhagen, Denmark, and is the co-author of the Noma Guide to Fermentation. On our website, you can find a video of René and his co-author David Zilber, who directs Noma's fermentation lab. And we buried the lead here a little bit, but you can also get the recipes for their three favorite fermented things, including that chicken wing garum. That's at splendidtable.org and our YouTube page. So I have to say, that book, The Noma Guide to Fermentation, is really something special. I mean, there are great fermentation books out there. I, for instance, love Sander Katz's terrific manual called Wild Fermentation. But René and David's book is a different take. It's both a great beginner's overview, and it's also creative and artistic, and I really recommend checking it out. That said, you know, this stuff isn't rocket science. And our friend Dan Souza from America's Test Kitchen is here with a super simple, traditional home fermentation project that's really worth making, and Sally Swift is a little obsessed with it.
Hey Dan, great to have you with us.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
So we have been talking fermentation this hour with René Redzepi of Noma, and he is doing some incredible things. But one of the things that I noticed is he doesn't do any dairy in this book, which is interesting to me because I think those are some of the most successful in easy fermentation projects.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, that's one of the cool things about fermentation is you can do what René does and just push the envelope so far. But at its core, fermentation is something that's been happening in people's kitchen for a long time, whether they
know it
tried
or not
to control it. Yeah, whether it just happened. And I do think some dairy culturing and fermentation, you can produce really interesting flavors. My favorite is doing cultured butter. I think it's a really big bang for your buck. And you can make stuff that honestly rivals what you can buy at the store. And it's really cool when you can actually do that.
So why does culturing butter make it taste better?
Well, so I should first back up and say that it used to be that all butter was cultured and not really on purpose. So basically, when you'd milk a cow, you'd set the milk aside and you'd let it sit for a while. During that process, the cream would flocculate, which means the butter fat rises to the top. And we know that, you know, if you have unhomogenized milk, you have that kind of cream layer at the top. While you wait for that to happen in the old days without refrigeration, there'd be natural bacteria that was in the container that you put the milk in, that was just in the atmosphere, and that would start the culturing process. So for a long time, all butter was cultured. When we got, you know, refrigeration and we got really good control over sanitation, we started producing butter that was really clean flavored, that didn't have any of the bacteria in there. And so we're kind of going backwards a little bit in order to recapture some of those flavors. So what we like to do is start with a really good quality heavy cream. So you want to look for something that is pasteurized but not ultra pasteurized. The pasteurized stuff tends to have more flavor to it, and it produces a butter that's a little bit nicer. And so to about a quart of cream, we add 2 tablespoons of buttermilk. You can start your cultured butter with a number of different starters. Buttermilk is one. Some people use yogurt, but buttermilk is really going to produce the best flavors, what we found.
Okay.
And so when you add that to it, you have these live bacterial cultures in there, and they go to work particularly on the lactose, which is the sugar that we find in milk, and it converts a lot of that to lactic acid. So we start to get some sourness, and that's really characteristic of cultured dairy in general. But another really interesting thing happens when that bacteria starts working. It produces a compound called diacetyl. And you can actually find that word diacetyl on the back of microwave popcorn, a lot of artificial products that they want to taste buttery because it has a buttery flavor. And so the bacteria actually naturally produces this diacetyl. And the more of that you produce, the more buttery your butter is going to be. So that's the interesting thing about cultured butter. A lot of people think, oh, maybe it's going to be tart, it's going to be sour. You might get a little bit of that, but really what you're getting is a more buttery product.
Wow, that is really, really interesting.
So you start with a quart of heavy cream, and you just simply add 2 tablespoons of buttermilk to it. Put a lid on that, and then let it sit at room temperature. So the bacteria is going to have, at a warmer temperature, is going to go to work a lot faster. And so you can let it sit for anywhere from 24 hours up to 7 days
wow.
on the counter. Yeah. We did testing all the way up to 7 days, and we found that at the high end of that range, you get some really funky stuff going on, and we really like it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's personal taste, see what you like, but the buttermilk itself gets really, really flavorful. Mm-hmm. So when you actually churn it and get the buttermilk out, it's really intense. A lot of people find it too intense, but the butter itself doesn't pick up as much of that flavor. So at 7 days, we found it really complex, really buttery. But anywhere on that spectrum, you can totally kind of say, okay, I call it, and now I'm going to make butter out of it. And then so at that point, it's pretty simple. You basically put it back in the fridge until it reaches about 55 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the ideal temperature for churning. If it's too cold, it's going to be really hard to churn. It's going to kind of stick to the blades in the food processor. And if it's not cold enough, the butterfat won't be firm enough to actually produce solid butterflecks that stick together. So once it reaches 55 degrees, take it out, you throw it in your food processor, and you run it really, really briefly. Basically, you're going to see it turn from cream to whipped cream. And then as more of those fat globules start jamming together and forming larger and larger particles, it can no longer hold onto the air that was incorporated in the beginning. Ah. And it can no longer hold onto the water in the mix. And that stuff will just splash out. So you'll get these really gorgeous golden orbs sitting in this white buttermilk. So at that point, you stop the machine, you take it out, and you pass it through cheesecloth. So you want to make sure you collect that buttermilk. Mm-hmm. That buttermilk is really flavorful, and you can drink it. You can add it to smoothies. You can use it in your baking. And then you kind of give it a nice squeeze so you get as much of that out as you can. And then you want to put that butter into an ice bath for a couple of minutes. And what that does is it firms up the butter. So then you can do the final step, which is kind of a hand kneading step. So you take the butter out of the cheesecloth, and in a big bowl, you press it with a wooden spoon, and you'll actually see buttermilk kind of burst out of it in pockets. Mm. So there's extra buttermilk kind of trapped in there that you want to get rid of. So knead it for a couple of minutes, and then you're ready to go. Your butter is done. You can either add a little salt at that point if you want salted butter, or just go right onto some bread
wow,
and start eating.
That is insanely easy. So the food processor is actually doing the job that a churning would do, right?
I mean, exactly. Yeah, it's just a really efficient way of getting it done. We also tried doing it in a stand mixer, but because it's open, you get a lot of splashing when it finally breaks into butter. We just found it a lot easier to use the food processor for it.
And then one more question. So if you are going to leave your butter concoction out for 7 days, you don't have to do anything to it. It's just sitting there. You're not feeding it like you would a sourdough starter or anything.
That's right. You don't have to do anything to it. You know what I actually like to do? I do this all the time is I'll start on Sunday, I'll start a batch. And after 24 hours, you have a quart container of creme fraiche, which I love using in my cooking. Mm-hmm. So I will just reach over with a spoon, take a spoon out, throw it into a pan sauce, maybe throw it on some bread, do whatever you want with it. And then whatever is left, and hopefully there's a lot left so you didn't eat too much creme fraiche during the week. Whatever's left at the end of the week, you turn that into butter and you've got that, you know, in your fridge for a couple weeks.
Oh, that is such a great idea. I am absolutely starting this on Sunday.
Do it.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Sally.
Dan Souza is editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated. You can find the recipe for DIY cultured butter at splendidtable.org. And our friends at ATK have a new podcast of their own. It's hosted by Bridget Lancaster, and it's called Proof. It's all about those, you know, those little teeny food questions that you just can't get out of your head, and they will explain it all away. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. And that is our show for the week. Thank you so much for spending the time with us and with Renee. And until next week, eat well, drink well, and feed those microbes. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thank you to everyone who contributes and makes this show possible. We literally can't do it without you. And to help support our show, just go to splendidtable.org. Special thanks this week to cooks of Crocus Hill in St. Paul, Minnesota, for letting us in the kitchen with Renee and David. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.